This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest today is the Poet Laureate of the United States, Ted Kooser. And he'll say hello with an opening poem.
Hello. Happy to be here. People from time to time have asked me for whom I write, and this is an attempt, rather tongue-in-cheek, to get at that. It's called Selecting a Reader. First, I would have her be beautiful, and walking carefully up on my poetry at the loneliest moment of an afternoon, her hair still damp at the neck from washing it. She should be wearing a raincoat, an old one, dirty from not having money enough for the cleaners. She will take out her glasses, and there in the bookstore she will thumb over my poems, then put the book back up on the shelf. She will say to herself, "For that kind of money, I can get my raincoat cleaned," and she will.
That is the voice of Ted Kooser. I'm Grace Cavalieri. What was in your mind when the phone rang and the librarian from the Library of Congress, Mr. Billington, invited you to be the Poet Laureate of the United States?
Utter confusion.
Utter confusion. And from that moment on, what has occupied your mind?
Well, I've thought a great deal about what I might do during this time and, making preparations to be gone. I'm kind of a stay-at-home guy and so on.
And what might you be accomplishing? What do you think you might do?
Well, the very first thing I did was get hold of the National Council of Teachers of English and ask if I could go to their convention in Indianapolis in November so that I could have the chance to talk to a lot of English teachers about poetry teaching.
Ted Kooser, but we're here to hear your poetry. And may I say, I want to be one of the millions who say thank you for coming. And may we hear your voice.
Thank you. This is a poem about the area we live in Nebraska. It's called In Late Spring. One of the National Guard's F-4 jet fighters, making a long approach to the Lincoln airfield, comes howling in over the treetops, its shadow flapping along behind it like the skin of a sheep, setting the coyotes crying back in the woods, and then the dogs, and then there is a sudden quiet that rings a little, the way an empty pan rings when you wipe it dry. And then it is Sunday again, a summer Sunday afternoon, and beyond my window the Russian olives sigh foolishly into the air through the throats of their flowers, and bluegills nibble the clouds afloat on the pond. Under the windmill, a cluster of peonies huddles, bald-headed now, and standing in piles of old papers. Beneath its lipstick, the mouth of the tulip is twisted. Spring moves on her run-down, broken toe shoes into the summer, trailing green ribbons of silk. I have been reading for hours, or intending to read, but over the bee song of the book, I could faintly hear my neighbor up the road a quarter mile, calling out to his daughter, and hear her calling back, not in words but in musical notes. Now that they have fallen quiet, and I have listened long into their absence, I have forgotten my place in the world. But the world knows my place and stands and holds a chair for me here on these acres near Garland, Nebraska. This April, in good health, I entered my 65th year. The perfect porcelain bells of Lily of the Valley ring into the long, shy ears of the ferns, and the horsefly sits in the sun and twirls his mustache and brushes the dust from his satin sleeves.
That's Ted Kooser. We're at the Library of Congress. Perfect Ted Kooser poem. Looking at the world through this sparkling, clean pane of glass. Very clear, very exact.
Thank you.
And all the senses are there. We have something to smell. We have something to taste. We have something to see. If I were to say that the one poet that you bring to mind is Stanley Kunitz, would you understand that?
Yes, I would. I admire Stanley Kunitz's work a great deal.
And there is at the center a character sometimes in his work. But William Blake said that the tear is an intellectual thing. Kunitz uses that as an epigraph, and that really brings you to mind because you have brought the tear as a perfectly respectable part of the Academy. There is always something to feel in your work.
Well, you know, if you don't push the edge with your feelings. I don't think you really have much of anything. There's an old Charlie Chaplin movie in which Chaplin is skating along the edge of a mezzanine in a department store during construction, and there's the chance always that he's going to fall into the pit. And the thrill of watching that scene is holding your breath, thinking that he's going over the edge. Well, that's where you have to be when you're writing, out on that edge, I think.
Mm. Ted Kooser, I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're here to hear another poem.
There are a lot of people getting tattoos today, and this is a poem about an older tattoo. What once was meant to be a statement, a dripping dagger held in the fist of a shuddering heart, is now just a bruise on a bony old shoulder, the spot where vanity once punched him hard and the ache lingered on. He looks like someone you had to reckon with, strong as a stallion, fast and ornery. But on this chilly morning, as he walks between the tables at a yard sale, with the sleeves of his tight black T-shirt rolled up to show us who he was, he is only another old man, picking up broken tools and putting them back, his heart gone soft and blue with stories.
Ted Kooser is the author of 10 collections of poetry, most recently Delights and Shadows. We'll be hearing a lot of that today. He was born in Ames, Iowa, and he got his degree at Iowa State University and his master's at the University of Nebraska. He has some other collections of poetry, Sure Signs, which won the Society of Midland Authors Prize, One World at a Time, Weather Central, and another is called Winter Morning Walks, 100 Postcards to Jim Harrison, and we will be finding out who this mysterious Jim Harrison is a little bit later on. So before we launch into some more, I have to comment on that poem, The Diminishing Tattoo.
Mm-hmm.
The law of diminishing returns is a haunting theme in your work. The man whose hat is too small, in another one of your poems, his head is now too small for the hat. Always the impending loss, but you are there right before it goes away. All of your poems are there right in the rest home before the death, right at the elderly woman's living room to speak of your mother's death, before her demise. You are there at the brink of diminishment.
Grace, I really appreciate the way you've read my work. I mean, you know, I'm very often interviewed by people who have not really studied my work, and you are dead right with that I am standing at that point, yeah.
And I'm sure you can't think of it when you're doing it.
Oh, no.
That's not something. Yeah, but it is a haunting aftertaste in your work, and so let's continue on and see if I'm right.
This poem is called A Rainy Morning. Again, this is a situation I saw someone on the street. A young woman in a wheelchair wearing a black nylon poncho spattered with rain is pushing herself through the morning. You have seen how pianists sometimes bend forward to strike the keys, then lift their hands, draw back to rest, then lean again to strike just as the chord fades. Such is the way this woman strikes at the wheels, then lifts her long white fingers, letting them float, then bends again to strike just as the chair slows, as if into a silence. So expertly she plays the chords of this difficult music she has mastered, her wet face beautiful in its concentration, while the wind turns the pages of rain.
And let's have two more, and we'll see what we have as a continuum.
Every year I write a Valentine poem and send it to a long list of people, and this was the 2004 Valentine, Splitting an Order. I like to watch an old man cutting a sandwich in half. Maybe an ordinary cold roast beef on whole wheat bread, no pickles or onion, keeping his shaky hands steady by placing his forearms firm on the edge of the table and using both hands, the left to hold the sandwich in place and the right to cut it surely, corner to corner, observing his progress through glasses that moments before he wiped with his napkin, and then to see him lift half onto the extra plate that he asked the server to bring, and then to wait, offering the plate to his wife, while she slowly unrolls her napkin and places her spoon, her knife, and her fork in their proper places, then smooths the starched white napkin over her knees and meets his eyes and holds out both old hands to him. And this poem, called Weather Central, describes how the weatherman stands in front of the projection of the map and sort of extends his arm and smooths the map with his hand. Weather Central. Each evening at 6:15, the weatherman turns a shoulder to us, extends his hand, and talking softly as a groom, cautiously smooths and strokes the massive, dappled flank of the continent, touching the cloudy whorls that drift like galaxies across its hide, tracing the loops of harness with their barbs and bells and pennants. Then, with a horsefly's touch, he brushes a mountain range and sets a shudder running just under the skin. His bearing is cavalier from years of success, and he laughs at the science, yet makes no sudden moves that might startle that splendid order or loosen the physics. One would not want to wake the enormous Appaloosa mare of weather, asleep in her stall on a peaceful moonlit night.
Ted Kooser.
One more poem about something that a glimpse of a person, Skater. She was all in black, but for a yellow ponytail that trailed from her cap, and bright blue gloves that she held out wide, the feathery fingers spread, as surely she stepped, click-clack, onto the frozen top of the world. And there, with a clatter of blades, she began to braid a loose path that broadened into a meadow of curls. Across the ice she swooped and then turned back, and halfway bent her legs and leapt into the air the way a crane leaps, blue gloves lifting her lightly, and turned a snappy half-turn there in the wind before coming down, arms wide, skating backward right out of that moment, smiling back at the woman she'd been just an instant before.
Now we could look at those poems, we can look at that poem and say, well, that's a perfect portrait of a skater. He's caught her freeze frame. But we could also look at that poem and say at that second that you've compressed time and mortality and then it fans out again. I mean, that's magic.
That is magic. Thank you.
And we do see in all of your work that you are a noticer of people.
I try to pay attention to people and things. The poet Linda Gregg said one time that she asks her students to notice six things a day, and I think that that's a marvelous practice. It's very difficult for most of us to pay attention to just six things a day.
You even notice bugs.
I'm kind of taken with bugs.
You certainly are. I've learned more about bugs from your memoirs. The leaf-footed bug?
The leaf-footed bug is a kind of a squash beetle, I think.
Never been in my life before, and I must admit, I did not know how to move an outhouse until I read your work either.
Well, now you know, in case it's ever necessary.
It's very illuminating. I'll tell you, you have brought a whole new dimensions into the world of poetry, and we're going to hear some more of them. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress with the new poet laureate, Ted Kooser. And I'll tell you a little bit more about him. He has won several awards and honors, NEA fellowships, the Pushcart Prize. Do you remember which poem that happened to be for, the Pushcart?
The Pushcart Prize was for a poem called As the President Spoke. It was about a poem about watching Ronald Reagan at the podium.
He has won a merit award from the Nebraska Arts Council. He is editor and publisher of Windflower Press, and that is a small poetry press. And he teaches as a visiting professor in the English department of the University of Nebraska. What is your teaching load? Is it one course, a visitor?
One course a semester.
Mm-hmm. Creative writing?
Yes, graduate students.
Mm-hmm. And how long has that been going on?
Oh, I've been doing that about 5 years now, since I retired from the insurance company.
Yes, I forgot to say that like Wallace Stevens, you were a man of the world. You counted money, and you dealt with paper, and you were an executive with a life insurance company. But always a poet?
Always a poet, yeah. The life insurance job was mainly to support my writing, and I would get up very early in the morning before I had to get my suit and tie on and do my writing from 4:30 to about 7.
Like Toynbee, right, or like a mother with small children. Mm-hmm. I think 5 to 7 is really when the muse comes to call, and we'll see some more poems. Ted Kooser.
At the Cancer Clinic. She is being helped toward the open door that leads to the examining rooms by two young women I take to be her sisters. Each bends to the weight of an arm and steps with the straight, tough bearing of courage. At what must seem to be a great distance, a nurse holds the door, smiling and calling encouragement. How patient she is in the crisp white sails of her clothes. The sick woman peers from under her funny knit cap to watch each foot swing, scuffing forward, and take its turn under her weight. There is no restlessness or impatience or anger anywhere in sight. Grace fills the clean mold of this moment, and all the shuffling magazines grow still.
The crisp white sails.
That poem, I was particularly pleased. I showed that to my doctor, and he made a copy of it and had it framed for the nurse's station at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. And I felt, oh boy, I've written something that someone is getting some use out of. You know, it was wonderful.
You know, to be appreciated by the medical profession.
Yeah.
That's...
He had me do a reading to the staff at the medical center once, which was you know, a very short reading, but at a big meeting, they had all the staff there.
Well, I call you the poet of affirmation.
Well, thank you.
And I think that is what he wanted to have happen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as much goodwill as you can bring in that people can understand. And I think that's why you're being applauded, because we've waited for a very long time to have something that belonged to everyone. And
well,
your poetry,
you,
on the literal level, will belong to every nurse in the back ward, but can also be, I see, subject for some very philosophical thought. So I'm looking forward to the rest of that book on your lap. But I want to say some things that people have talked about. And Poetry Magazine said, Kuser documents the dignities, habits, and small griefs of daily life, our hunger for connection, our struggle to find balance. And another says, the Minneapolis Star Tribune says, Kuser will one day rank alongside Edgar Lee Masters, Robert Frost, and William Carlos Williams. I think that is telling. I think
I'll either rank beside them or be lying beside them.
Actually, I like you better than Edgar Lee Masters, but William Carlos Williams would write about a little broken green piece of glass in the hospital court driveway, wouldn't he?
Yeah,
he taught me.
Williams taught me to look at things like that, sure.
Absolutely, you do it too. Well, let's look some more.
This is a poem. I've written several poems about these little moments in life that there's a little bit of tension that passes, and this is, I would guess most of the audience has experienced this. In passing, from a half block off, I see you coming, walking briskly along, carrying parcels, furtively glancing up into the faces of people approaching, looking for someone you know, holding your smile in your mouth like a pebble, keeping it moist and ready, being careful not to swallow. I know that hope so open on your face, know how your heart would lift to see just one among us who remembered. If only someone would call out your name, would smile, so happy to see you again. You shift your heavy parcels, hunch up your shoulders, and press ahead into the moment. From a few feet away, you recognize me, or think you do. I see you preparing your face, getting your greeting ready. Do I know you? Both of us wonder. Swiftly, we meet and pass, averting our eyes. Close enough to touch, but not touching. I could not let you know that I've forgotten, and yet you know.
You have one poem that ends, and no one to tell about it.
Oh, yes.
Yes, and now I was wondering that you are going to be heard by millions of people. Does that feeling change? Do you feel you'll be heard? That what you have to tell will be heard?
Well, I certainly hope that I'll get some more readers out of this. It's not a matter of, you know, wanting to make money selling books, but I really enjoy having readers, and especially having people write letters to me and tell me that a poem has meant something to them.
I wish people would know that the poet really does want to hear. They always think, oh, I wouldn't want to bother him, you know. But quite the contrary. You don't know anyone's out there unless they do tell you.
Yeah, and I try to write myself. I try to write, you know, a card to somebody when I see a poem that I like.
Oh, good.
So, you know, yeah.
Okay. We're talking about a book. I think you're reading from Delights and Shadows.
Yes, mostly.
Uh-huh. Mostly. And that is just out, 2004. And Charles Baxter said, Ted Kooser has great gifts for both portraiture and landscape, and another gift for dramatizing what is nearly invisible. That's the part I like. He is a seer, and we are lucky to have him among us and blessed to have these beautiful new poems. And it's being in touch with the invisible that I'm there.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I am. Love to hear some more.
Okay.
We're at the Library of Congress.
This is a poem about a thing. I've written a lot of poems about things. A spiral notebook. You've seen these. The bright wire rolls like a porpoise in and out of the calm blue sea of the cover, or perhaps like a sleeper twisting in and out of his dreams. For it could hold a record of dreams if you wanted to buy it for that, though it seems to be meant for more serious work, with its college-ruled lines and its cover that states in emphatic white letters, 5, subject, notebook. It seems a part of growing old is no longer to have 5 subjects, each demanding an equal share of attention, set apart by brown cardboard dividers, but instead to stand in a drugstore and hang on to one subject a little too long, like this notebook you weigh in your hands, passing your fingers over its surfaces as if it were some kind of wonder. Here's another poem about a thing as such. David Quammen is an essayist, writes wonderful things about nature, and he wrote an essay in which he described a moth that drinks tears. And the title of the poem is The Species, Lobocraspis grisifusa. This is the tiny moth who lives on tears, who drinks like a deer at the gleaming pool at the edge of the sleeper's eye. The touch of its mouth is light as a cloud's reflection. In your dream, a moonlit figure appears at your bedside and touches your face. He asks if he might share the poor bread of your sorrow. You show him the table. The two of you talk long into the night, but by morning the words are forgotten. You awaken serene in a sunny room, rubbing the dust of his wings from your eyes.
Now, just as far as your process goes, I said to myself, did he, in writing that, have the center of the poem already committed to a page so that when you wrote about the event, you plugged it in? Or did you write that poem as a piece of ribbon, all one process? There seems to be a centerpiece in there, a little white light at the center that you may have been harboring elsewhere.
Well, I might have. Frankly, I don't remember exactly the process on that poem, but my usual process would be pretty linear. I would write from front to back and then go back into it with countless revisions and see what I could make of it. And my guess is that what you're referring to is something that came in through the revision.
I see. You don't have a little messy box of dirty pieces of paper that you scramble through when you can't get an idea?
No.
You have to get one.
I'm too Germanic and compulsive to have a box of little scraps of paper.
Good. That's a good segue. Germanic and compulsive. We have to seg now to your memoirs, which are about the place of Germans and Czechs,
mm-hmm.
the Bohemian Alps. And I'm just going to take a short detour and get back to your poetry.
Okay.
Because we have to congratulate the new book, Local Wonders. And it is subtext, Seasons in the Bohemian Alps. The book is separated into seasons, and it is your view of living among your people, peppered with these wonderful folk sayings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are those folk sayings something you collected on index cards, or do they just come with?
You know, as I mentioned earlier, I'm kind of a devotee of garage sales and yard sales, and it was a book that I found at a yard sale. It's called International Proverbs, and it had a section of Czech and Bohemian proverbs.
Oh.
And I got most of them out of that.
They are wonderful.
Yeah, I
love
them.
They are so wonderful.
The marvelous one that, heads the book, when God wishes to rejoice the heart of a poor man, he makes him lose his donkey and find it again. I just love that.
And you speak of that when you had recovered from a very serious illness.
Yes, uh-huh.
And you found your donkey again.
Yeah, yeah.
So the book comes full circle with that idea.
Mm-hmm.
That's really important. And when we think of the people that you talk about in this book, we know so much about your life intimately. And I'll give you an example. You talk about, well, I think of how busy you're going to be this winter. And you say in this book that winter is your favorite season because you can stay all day in your long flannel shirt that your mother made you, looking out over the snow that covers all the chores that you don't have to do.
That's right.
Ted, this is going to be a different kind of winter.
Yes, indeed.
No flannel shirts in Washington.
No, no. I'm going to be, year is going to be quite a disruption, but I'm willing to accept it. So,
Ted Kuser, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and I can't be happier because we're going to hear some more.
Okay. My grandmother, Mosier, my mother's mother, had a set of pink Depression glass dishes, and I wrote this about those. Depression glass. It seemed those rose-pink dishes she kept for special company were always cold, brought down from the shelf in jingling stacks, the plates like the panes of ice she broke from the water bucket winter mornings, the flaring cups like tulips that opened too early and got bitten by frost. They chilled the coffee no matter how quickly you drank, while a heavy everyday mug would have kept a splash hot for the better part of a conversation. It was hard to hold up your end of the gossip with your coffee cold, but it was a special occasion, just the same, to sit at her kitchen table and sip the bitter percolation of the past week's rumors from cups it had taken a year to collect at the grocery, with one piece free for each 5 pounds of flour.
You had two grandmothers.
Yes, indeed.
You had a very nuclear family, and Grace Kuser was your father's mother?
Yes.
And I know because her name's Grace.
Yeah.
So I thought she was a large woman.
She was a very large woman. I remember sitting, when we were very small, she made paper dolls for us, and my sister and I sat at her knees, and she would make these paper dolls, and I'd look up at these enormous knees. They were like the faces on Mount Rushmore, you know.
And you liked your mother's mother better.
Well, actually, my grandmother Kuser died when I was about 10, but my grandmother Mosier lived on for many years, and we really spent much more time with the Mosiers than the Kuser. My grandfather Kuser died quite when I was very small, yeah.
But the characters in your life will live longer than you do because it's kind of impressive that they've been made immortal.
Well, you know, the University of Nebraska Press is about to publish a little book of mine, a kind of a special edition called Lights on a Ground of Darkness. It is a reminiscence of my grandmother Mosier's family. And I had written it as an essay and published it in the Great River Review. And the press came to me and said they were looking for a book that they could give to donors at the university, a sort of special edition. So they were interested in looking at this. And, it only runs in print. It only ran about 45 pages, so it'll be a very slim book. But I was delighted by this because it was a real labor of love. My mother was dying when I was writing it. I wanted to finish it and show her the manuscript before she was gone. And I thought it would make her terribly sad, but in fact she liked it. But it was exactly as you say. It was my attempt to keep some very ordinary people alive.
Oh, books matter.
Mm-hmm. They certainly do.
You have to mention that there will be another, you're keeping the University of Nebraska up late. They have another book coming out from you called The Poetry Home Repair Manual. Now, there are no loose hammers here, huh? Mm. You're going to tell us how to do it.
Well, I'm not. You know, it is not a book of real specifics. You know, they're my ideas about the things I do best, work with metaphor, fine-tuning metaphor, things about, but they're also it's more of a philosophy of writing. And I say, you know, I believe in writing as communication. If you don't believe in that, you have no business with this book because it's not for you, and so on. But that there are readers out there, and we have to think about what we are giving an audience.
What do you do with your dreams?
I sometimes drop dreams into journals and so on, you know, but I have not really ever, well, from time to time, I guess I've written about them, yeah.
Maybe little droplets. It feels as if you carry everything you felt with you at all times. That's what it feels like when I read your work.
I don't know how other people operate, you know, psychologically, but at some given moment in every day, I momentarily review every person I have ever known, I think. It is like there's a constant parade. I mean, not everyone I've ever known, like, I shouldn't say that, but the people who have mattered to me, I sort of check in with them every day at some point in a way.
Alive or dead?
Oh, yeah, mostly dead.
Me
actually.
Too.
Yeah.
That's where the best communication's happening.
Yeah, isn't that interesting the way
yes.
that works? So you do that too?
I do. I'm in constant communication with the invisible.
Mm-hmm.
Ted Kooser, Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and I'm glad. So please tell us more.
This is a poem that's sort of fun. I often read this at public readings because everyone in the audience has experienced this. It's called The Urine Specimen. In the clinic, a sun-bleached shell of stone on the shore of the city, you enter the last small chamber, a little closet chastened with pearl, cool, white, and glistening. And over the chilly well of the toilet, you trickle your precious sum in a cup. It's as simple as that. But the heat of this gold your body's melted and poured out into a form begins to enthrall you, warming your hand with your flesh's fevers in a terrible way. It's like holding an organ, spleen or fatty pancreas, a lobe from your foamy brain still steaming with worry. You know that just outside a nurse is waiting to cool it into a gel and slice it onto a microscope slide for the doctor, who in it will read your future, wringing his hands. You lift the chalice and toast the long life of your friend there in the mirror, who wanly smiles but does not drink to you.
I think you've taken the embarrassment out of bodily functions in your work. In your memoirs, we have some tapeworms, we have all kinds of things exposed to literature, and it takes the sting out of it, doesn't it? Because you're saying all things are holy. All things are holy. That's what you say.
I think I am saying that. Sometimes poems don't really require a lot of ornamentation when it comes to figurative language, I think, and that's when the poem itself presents an experience that is so vivid in its plain details that it really works, and I assume that this poem works that way. A deck of pornographic playing cards. We were 10 or 11, my friend and I, when we found them up under a bridge on top of a beam where pigeons were resting. Someone had carefully hidden them there. On each was a black and white photo, no two cards alike. We grew quiet and older, young men on our haunches, staring at what we feared might be the future. The pigeons flapped back to their roosts, rustling and cooing. The river gurgled as it slipped from the bridge's cool shadow. There were women with big muzzled dogs, women with bottles and broom handles. Stallions stood over the bodies of others. The women smiled and licked their lips with tongues like thorns. We grew old. Mm. We were two old men with stiff legs and sad hearts. We had wanted to laugh, but we couldn't. Mm. We had thought we were boys, come there to throw stones at the pigeons, but we were already dying inside.
What is that line, we were afraid it would happen? Looking at what we might afraid might happen, what is that line? That is a line the whole poem turns on.
Staring at what we feared might be the future.
Oh. What a line. You could have said that with more bumps in it.
Oh,
that's a goodie. Staring at what we feared
might be the future.
Yeah.
Now, this poem, on the other hand, is more of a metaphor than that last poem. I mean, this poem is a metaphor that is extended. One of my favorite ways of writing. You leap off, you take off from the objective world, go spinning off into the imaginary world, and then try to tether it down at the end. Etude. I have been watching a great blue heron fish in the cattails, easing ahead with the stealth of a lover composing a letter, the hungry words looping in blue as they coil and uncoil, as they kiss and sting. Let's say that he holds down an everyday job in an office. His blue suit blends in. Long days swim beneath the glass top of his desk, each one alike. On the lip of each morning, a bubble trembles. No one has seen him there, writing a letter to a woman he loves. His pencil is poised in the air like the beak of a bird. He would spear the whole world if he could, toss it and swallow it live.
What book is that from?
That's from Weather Central.
Oh.
It's the opening poem in Weather Central, yeah. Now, this one is a little longer poem, but it's very interesting, I think. It's a narrative. I don't write a whole lot of narrative poems, but it's a story that was told to me by Keith Jacobshagen, who's a very dear friend of mine, is a noted landscape painter. And this is about his family, the beaded purse. Dressed in his church suit and under the shadow of his hat, the old man stood on the wooden depot platform 3 feet above the rest of Kansas while the westbound freight chuffed in and hissed to a stop. He and the agent and 2 men, commercial travelers waiting to go on west, pull mail bags out of the steam, then slid out his daughter's coffin, canvas over wood, and set it on a nearby baggage cart. Not till the train had rolled away and tooted once as it passed the shacks on the leading edge of the distance, and not till the agent had disappeared, dragging the bags of mail behind, did the old man pry up the nailed-down lid with the bar he'd brought in the wagon. Hat in hand, he took a long look. He hadn't seen her in a dozen years. At 19, without his blessing, she'd gone back east to be an actress, now and then writing her mother in a carefree, ne'er-do-well cursive to say she was happy living in style. A week before, the agent sent word that there was a telegram waiting, and the old man and his wife rode the town to read that their daughter had died, and her remains were on the way home. Remains, that's how they put it. She was wearing a fancy yellow dress, but was no longer young and pretty. She looked like one of the worn-out dolls she'd left in her room at the farm, where he would sometimes go to sit. A bag of women's private underthings had been stuffed between her feet, and someone had pushed down next to her an evening bag beaded with pearls. He opened the purse and found it empty, so he took a few bills out of his pocket and folded them in, then snapped it closed for her mother to find. Then, with the back of the bar, he tapped the lid in place and went to find the station agent. The two of them lifted the coffin down and carried it a few hard yards across the sunny, dusty floor of Kansas and loaded it onto the creaking wagon. Then, clapping his hat on his head and slapping the plump rump of his mare with the reins, he started the long haul home with his rich and famous daughter.
Mm. What a cinematic moment I can just see. A Mike Leigh film where they open the purse and put the money in.
It's a whole movie, isn't it, that story?
It is a film. Yeah. It is. Mm-hmm. Hearing you, I thought, well, he's got a really good voice and he reads very well. But then I got in touch with your vowels. I know that you cannot prescribe this ahead of time, but one of the worn-out dolls. I can follow your vowels through the line, the plump rump, and I think that this is the remarkable thing that makes you read it so easily. I'm sure you don't know ahead of time that your vowels are that way, but what are you aware of?
I'm very much blessed with that, with the gift of that. I think one of the very first poems I wrote when I was a very young man, 20 years old, was an exercise that a teacher had given me in writing rhymed couplets. And I described a cemetery in a mole underground, tunneling through the cemetery, sort of a Gothic sort of scene. But I look back at that poem now and I see all these vowels and internal rhymes that just seem to flow into the poem, you know. And I am very much blessed by having had that happen to me. I don't think about those things when I write. They're just there.
I think writers are wired a certain way.
Yeah, it could be.
Just when you're born, your brain just has vowels in it.
Yeah.
Ted Kooser is here. He's our No Poet Laureate of the United States. What a title. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and he's going to read some more.
I have a on our acreage that we have a little pond, and down by the pond I have a building with windows in it where I keep a lot of the books that won't fit in the house, and I go down there to sit a lot. And next to it is a well pit, and the snakes come up, bull snakes and blue racers and garter snakes come up out of the well pit. They love it there. And one of the bull snakes comes over into my library when I'm not there and goes after the mice if there are any in there. And all I've ever seen of him is these snake skins that he leaves around. Snake skin. It is only the old yellow shell of something long gone on, a dusty tunnel echoing with light. Yet you can feel the speed along it, feel in your bones the tick of wheels. You hold a glove of lace, a loose glitter of sequins. The ghost of a wind is in it still, for someone only yesterday was waving it goodbye. Somewhere a long train crosses a border, the sun lights lamps in its thousand round windows. All it knows is behind it already. Nothing it knows is ahead. Its whistle flicks into the distance.
There's something, I don't know if it's in your memoirs, where someone's coming to fix a part of your house, and he's afraid of snakes. So you reach down and get the two snakes that are residing there and carry them across the frozen yard to keep them safe. Then after he fixes things, you pick the snakes up because you're afraid they'll freeze, and they're gone.
Yeah, that's right.
And my husband didn't believe that story. He hates snakes. But every living thing matters to you.
Yes, it does. Yeah, I have a, you know, we let the spiders live in our house because we live in the country where there are a lot of those little German wood roaches, you know, that live in stacks of firewood and so on. So the house would probably have cockroaches were it not for the spiders in the house, and the spiders hunt the cockroaches and so on, you know. It makes it sound like we're living in terrible circumstances. Actually, our house is practically brand new, but living in the country, there's a lot more insect life around and
But
and so on.
For you to spend 15 minutes looking at a bug, I think that's a man who does not race with a clock.
Yes, I try to take, you know, notice of things and so on, sure.
We'll continue.
This is a poem about my mother's first cousin, Ira Friedlein, who was a lovely man, and I went to see him at a nursing home shortly before he died, and he had a very pronounced blue age spot on his left hand, and that sort of stuck with me. A goodbye handshake. Though you and the nursing home are miles behind me now, your hand with its dark blue age spots is here in my hand, your fingers warm from all of the hot steel handles they held in your 88 years, levers of threshing machines, of sickle bar mowers and balers, but cooling now and slowly going all blue-black over brown, like a pool of blue oil on the floor of a barn, that darkness working its way up into the cuff of your new plaid shirt, up past your elbow, sharp as a plowshare there on the wheelchair armrest, easing over your heart like a shadow. 100 miles down the road, stopped by the highway and sitting in shade at the edge of a shimmering cornfield, I say goodbye. I am headed both farther and further than you, Ira Friedlein. With love I take your blue-black hand, which has held nearly everything once and has squeezed it shyly and politely. Here's another one. This is an elegy I wrote for my mother about a month after she died. Mother. Mid-April already, and the wild plums bloom at the roadside, a lacy white against the exuberant, jubilant green of new grass and the dusty, fading black of burnt-out ditches. No leaves, not yet, only the delicate star-petaled blossoms, sweet with their timeless perfume. You have been gone a month today and have missed 3 rains and 1 night-long watch for tornadoes. I sat in the cellar from 6 to 8 while fat spring clouds went somersaulting, rumbling east. Then it poured, a storm that walked on legs of lightning, dragging its shaggy belly over the fields. The meadowlarks are back and the finches are turning from green to gold. Those same 2 geese have come to the pond again this year, honking in over the trees and splashing down. They never nest, but stay a week or two, then leave. The peonies are up, the red sprouts burning in circles like birthday candles, for this is the month of my birth, as you know. The best month to be born in, thanks to you. Everything ready to burst with living. There will be no more new flannel nightshirts sewn on your old black Singer, no birthday card addressed in a shaky but businesslike hand. You asked me if I would be sad when it happened, and I am sad. But the iris I moved from your house now hold in the dusty, dry fists of their roots green knives and forks as if waiting for dinner, as if spring were a feast. I thank you for that. Were it not for the way you taught me to look at the world, to see the life at play in everything, I would have to be lonely forever.
What a line. Now is a good time to take another really quick detour, because I would hate to leave this program without mentioning your good friend Jim Harrison.
Yes.
And this is, we won't really have a chance to read your work with him, but we can mention it. Braided Creek is a book. It's Braided Creek, A Conversation in Poetry, came out in 2003. And it is simply a page with little poems on them, and they're not identified. We don't know whether Ted wrote them or his friend Jim Harrison. They're just thrown in the mix. Did that come from the book Postcards?
Well, when I was recovering from radiation, I wrote a poem every day and pasted it on a postcard and sent it to Jim. And it were about things that I would find on the road when I was out walking before dawn and so on. These little poems are actually poems that we corresponded with for over a longer period than that. I mean, some of them were interspersed in that period, but he and I have been exchanging poems for many years. And I arranged the book myself. They are not sequential, literally sequential. I had them all on 3x5 index cards, and I had two strips of 3x5 index cards, probably 35 feet long, and I went up and down and up and down until I could kind of braid them together in
a way.
And
they are, yeah, braided.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, you don't know who wrote what. So it's like a detective game. I thought, well, now here's somebody who just said he finishes a bottle of wine in 33 minutes. That is not Ted.
That indeed is not
no.
Ted. Yeah.
So I can sort of, you say you're the odd couple, right?
Yeah, that's right.
The wild, crazy guy and the conservative. And so I almost could tell which sounded like you just by the content. But it doesn't matter. Why doesn't it matter?
Well, one of the things I think that in a book of several hundred poems like this, to have the name of the poet underneath each poem would really interrupt the whole experience, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is, we decided that why call attention to that, you know, to the fact that Ted wrote this poem or Jimmy wrote this one and so on, you know. And we just decided we'd try it this way. And, of course, everyone is trying to figure out who wrote what, you know. And people say, well, I know that you wrote that one. I say, well, you know, I didn't write that one. And one of the interesting things was about it was that there were a couple of poems in that bunch of 3x5 cards that I couldn't remember, that we were close enough and are close enough that I couldn't remember which of us had written that one.
Well, I can understand that.
Yeah.
I can. Yeah. Where does he live?
He lives in Montana during the warmer months and in Arizona in the winter.
Does he like the fact that he's famous now, that you're poet laureate?
Well, I think Jim was very famous long before I became poet laureate.
His name is certainly well known.
Yeah. Particularly for his novels. And his movie work and so on, you know. Jim sees himself as being a poet. It was his first love, and he writes beautiful poems. But, you know, his reputation has been made in fiction, really.
Well, we have time for some more.
Okay. I read a poem about mother. This is a poem about my father, written on his birthday. Father, today you would be 97 if you had lived, and we would all be miserable, you and your children, driving from clinic to clinic, an ancient, fearful hypochondriac and his fretful son and daughter, asking directions, trying to read the complicated, fading map of cures. But with your dignity intact, you have been gone for 20 years, and I am glad for all of us, although I miss you every day. The heartbeat under your necktie, the hand cupped on the back of my neck, Old Spice in the air, your voice delighted with stories. On this day each year, you love to relate that at the moment of your birth, your mother glanced out the window and saw lilacs in bloom. Well, today, lilacs are blooming in side yards all over Iowa, still welcoming you. You know, I went on what would have been his 100th birthday. My wife and I drove over to Ames and went to that house and stood in the yard, and there's a lilac bush right there by the window, a 100-year-old lilac bush.
His exact age.
Yeah, oh yeah.
100. Yeah. When there's another poem where you end with his hands folding over your heart.
Yes, I don't have that one along today, but yeah.
You were very close.
Oh, yes, yeah.
You are accused of having a happy childhood.
Yes, that's right. All this business about artists having to have terrible childhoods doesn't play with me. That Keith Jacobshagen I mentioned, the painter whose story that was about the guy in Kansas and the coffin and so on, Keith had a blissfully happy childhood, and he's a marvelous painter, you know. His folks, I've been around them, they adore him, you know. And you can tell they've adored him since he was born. He's an only child.
Well, you say your mother's sun shone on you.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Do you remember the poet Roland Flint, the late poet?
Oh, yes, I did. Yeah.
Yes. He said that there were 6 children in the family, and everyone thought that he was his mother's favorite.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good,
yeah. Isn't
that's
that
a
nice?
Good thing
yeah.
to say.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who would you say is another Great Plains poet? McGrath. Was McGrath a Great Plains poet?
Tom McGrath is probably one of the greatest of the Great Plains poets, I think. And people, it's a shame. He's not known.
No.
His sort of magnum opus was Letter to an Imaginary Friend, which
right.
Comes up out of that Plains experience. McGrath was way over on the left politically,
yes,
and
he was.
Got blacklisted and one thing or another. And I think maybe that may have done some damage long-term to his career, but his poems are really beautiful. There's a Whitman conference coming up in the spring at Nebraska, and I'm to introduce that conference, and I'm going to read a poem of McGrath's because they are so much like Whitman and so much influenced by him, I think.
That will be very good because you're the only two that are known for that region, really.
Well, of course there are others
that
are not quite as well known. You know, I've been extremely lucky with my career. I think literary careers are about 40% skill and 60% just dumb luck, you know, and I've been very lucky with mine.
And then we go even norther and we get Robert Wrigley and
yeah.
so many fine poets.
Yeah, Bob Wrigley's a wonderful poet.
Yes.
That's true, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But right now we're with Ted Kooser. We're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress.
A sound in the night. There's a clock at the end of the pasture talking and talking. It's my neighbor's new electric fencer, a red tin box with a steady pulse. On a night like this, chilly and still, you can hear it knock for 100 yards, counting the stars with its bony knuckle, a sound absurd against the darkness. But many of us have stopped in our places to listen, a mouse with a globe of dew in her paws, a coyote lifting his head from the grass, his wet tail tipped with starlight. Even my father, dead these many years, has heard the flat, remorseless counting and reaches out into the darkness and over the years for my mother's hand. This is a poem I wrote after seeing a student walking across campus one day and realizing how much students with backpacks on look like sea turtles. Student. The green shell of his backpack makes him lean into wave after wave of responsibility, and he swings his stiff arms and cupped hands, paddling ahead. He's extended his neck to its full length, and his chin, hard as a beak, breaks the cold surf. He's got his baseball cap on backwards, as up he crawls, out of the froth of a hangover, and onto the sand of the future, and lumbers, heavy with hope, into the library.
May we have a final poem?
Here's a self-portrait. And the places that are mentioned in this poem are small towns near where I live. That was I. I was that older man you saw sitting in a confetti of yellow light and falling leaves on a bench at the empty horseshoe courts in Thayer, Nebraska, brown jacket, soft cap, wiping my glasses. I had noticed, of course, that the rows of sunken horseshoe pits were like old graves, but I was not letting my mind go there. Instead, I was looking with hope to a grapevine draped over a fence in a neighboring yard, and knowing that I could hold on. Yes, that was I. And that was I, the round-shouldered man you saw that afternoon in Rising City as you drove past the abandoned mini-golf, fists deep in my pockets, nose dripping, my cap pulled down against the wind as I walked the miniature main street, peering into the child-sized plywood store, the poor red school, the faded barn, thinking that not even in such an abbreviated world, with no more than its little events, the snap of a grasshopper's wing against a paper cup, could a person control this life? Yes, that was I. And that was I you spotted that evening just before dark in a weedy cemetery west of Staplehurst, down on one knee, as if trying to make out the name on a stone. Some lonely old man, you thought, come there to pity himself in the reliable sadness of grass among graves. But that was not so. Instead, I had found in its perfect web a handsome black and yellow spider, pumping its legs to try to shake my footing as if I were a gift, an enormous moth that it could snare and eat. Yes, that was I.
The voice of Ted Kooser, Poet Laureate of the United States. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media. Post-production is by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. The series is brought to you by the Humanities Council of Washington, D.C. and the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. You can hear the series on www.loc.gov/poetry. We wish to thank the Motion Picture Broadcasting and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. Our engineer is Bill Haley. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
Additional funding for The Poet and the Poem is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts, because a great nation deserves great art.